let's have a look now at, we're going to go and look at the Phoenicians, because they came from Lebanon, and they did a trip, it looks like, or did sort of several trips, or many trips, or thousands of trips across the Atlantic, potentially. Mm-hmm. But we're going to look at this chap called Philip Beale, who's done a trip the end of last year in a Phoenician reconstructed boat. But before that, let's have a little listen to an extract from, I think it's from quite a long time, maybe 2014 edition of In Our Time with Melvin Bragg, where they look at who the Phoenicians were. They were around 800 BC and a bit before and a bit after. But they were the seafaring people. And I sort of feel an affinity with them partly because, you know, the Mediterranean there's a lot of trade going on there thousands of years ago. And, of course, the Brits were very much a trading nation, a maritime nation. So let's have a listen now to Dr. Mark Woolmer speaking on the BBC In Our Time programme about the Phoenicians.
The Phoenicians were famous for their ability to craft the finest vessels. One of the interesting things that all of the ancient sources agree on is the speed of Phoenician vessels. They were fast. And this is because of one of the innovations that Phoenician shipwrights made, which was the cutwater.
Cutwater?
A cutwater, which is essentially a conical projection at the front of a vessel, and it cuts through the water ahead of the front of the ship, thus reducing drag on the hull and making the ship pass much quicker and much more easily across the surface of the ocean. They had sails and they had oars, so if you found yourself in the middle of the Mediterranean and the wind dropped and you're stuck, you could row, but sails were the main form of propulsion. They would use oars to row into shore and into harbour, but they would use sails in the open sea.
Do we know how they got so far ahead of their competitors? After all, the Mediterranean is ringed by cities and towns on the sea.
Well, they had no option in one sense, because of the geography and topography of Lebanon, ancient Phoenicia. On one side is the Mediterranean, on the other side is impenetrable mountains. There's very little farmland, there's very little agricultural land. So the one thing that they have an abundance of is timber. So they recognise that they can use the timber to manufacture boats and then harvest the benefits of the Mediterranean. So from a very early age, sort of even 1300 BC, we find depictions of Phoenician vessels. They're using hockey stick-like oars, they have masts, they even seem to have small sails. So they become a maritime nation from a very early date.
So that was Dr. Mark Woolmer from Durham University talking about the Phoenicians. Martin, the idea that somebody could have maybe made it to the Americas isn't so impossible, is it? Because we know that these maritime people were almost like the intelligence services of the ancient civilizations, because they went all around the world. They were finding stuff out, and they realized that the information they found out here, there, and everywhere had an enormous value. And they wouldn't just dish it out willy-nilly. They would maybe even make up cover stories of various sorts to try and explain things.
Well, I have to say, I don't find it at all convincing that they did cross the Atlantic. The Vikings certainly did cross the Atlantic. They went across the top.
Okay, but you see, there was a very strong connection between the Phoenicians and the Vikings, because their alphabet was quite like the Viking runes. So, maybe we should have a discussion with you when we've heard from Philip Beale, because he's a former Royal Navy officer who went out and made his fortune in order to try and build one of these, and he did build it, a Phoenician boat, in order to test to see whether these Phoenicians, how easy it would be to cross the Atlantic in one of them. So let's have a listen to the interview I did earlier this week now with Philip Beale.
My name is Philip Beale. I've got a background in adventure, culture, ancient histories. I did my first sort of Contiki-type expedition looking at how Asian influence got to Africa, Madagascar and West Africa.
How do you have a background in adventure? I mean, surely you need a lot of money to finance something like this.
Well, I started my sort of interest in this at university a long time ago now, and it took me 20 years to, you know, either save up enough money or build up the courage to do my first real adventure, which I did in 2003, which was this the Borobudur ship expedition that crossed the Indian Ocean. So I waited, or it took me 20 years of graft and work to be able to do it. And then once I had done that, out of that came the idea of, you know, having looked at how Africa was influenced by some of the Asian cultures, to look at, well, who were the first people to trade with Africa and circumnavigate it? And that's when I decided to build the, you know, the Phoenician ship.
You've also got a connection, haven't you, with the Royal Navy and with the City of London?
Yeah, correct, yes. Yeah. So I joined the Royal Navy in 1983. I had this vision that the Navy would, you know, be at my disposal and I could do as much adventure and travel as I wanted. And of course, that was a bit pretty badly misplaced. You know, I was reminded fairly quickly that, you know, the Navy had its ships to sail and to look after. And so I took the decision that if I really wanted to do what I've been doing now, is that I needed to, you know, get out of the Navy, earn some money. And yeah, I ended up in London working. And as I say, I worked there for like 15 years or so before I was in the right position to be able to do my first adventure.
Can I just ask you something about the Navy, though? Because this is obviously in your blood, the sea. What sort of stuff were you doing, without going into too much detail? Did you get around the world quite a bit with the Navy?
No, I went in after university as a junior officer, but I specialised in seamanship. So navigation was part of it. I sailed on two ships, HMS Cardiff and HMS Shetland. And, you know, I was clearly comfortable at sea. And it was a great, you know, opportunity, but I knew that I wanted to do more of the sort of Thor Heyerdahl Kon-Tiki kinds of things. And that was only reserved for people that were probably, you know, lieutenant commander and above, and that wasn't me.
It's worth mentioning the whole Kon-Tiki expedition, because that inspired, I mean, your generation and my generation remember seeing this, I think it was in the early 70s on television, which was, I believe it was an Egyptian vessel which was reconstructed, and then there was an attempt to sail it to America. Am I right about that?
Yes, so the first voyage that Thor Heyerdahl did was the Kon-Tiki, looking at whether the Pacific had been colonized from South America. And that was immensely influential, and the book, you know, inspired me as a teenager. But then later in the 1970s, much, you know, two or three decades after he'd done the Kon-Tiki expedition, he did the Ra voyage in a papyrus boat, which was sort of built and launched from Morocco, and he sailed that across the Atlantic. The first one sank, and the second one just about made it. Interestingly, you know, I think the idea was inspiring. It was a great idea. Realistically, though, I think, you know, we should credit the Egyptians with a lot more intelligence. They were already building wooden boats, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and they would have known that a papyrus boat would sink.
Is it made of rushes or something? That sounds to me as if you might just about cross a river in it, but not the Atlantic.
Exactly, that's right. It was made of these, you know, reeds, if you like, or papyrus reeds, and would just about last a few weeks until it sank. And of course, you'd get no real sort of navigation with it, but we know from the Cheops boat in the Egyptian pyramids that the Egyptians were building wooden boats at that time. And if they had any sense, you know, they would have actually used a wooden boat. And I think that's where the Phoenicians come in, because history records the Phoenicians were the sailors who were requested by Egyptian pharaohs to do their expeditions. And if anybody was going to sail across the Atlantic from the Mediterranean, it would have been the Phoenicians.
So what was the relationship between the Egyptian Empire and those Phoenicians then?
Yes, so you get, for example, Pharaoh Necho, around 600 BC, he was one of the most expansionist-minded pharaohs. He built the first Suez Canal, and although it was never completed, but he asked the Phoenician mariners to make the first circumnavigation of Africa, and that's been recorded by Herodotus. And the relationship was one of an alliance, really, between the Phoenicians and the Egyptians. And so the Phoenicians got their timbers, the Lebanese cedar, for example, and they worked very closely together. And a lot of Phoenician artisans, both metal workers, stone workers, worked for the Egyptians. And, of course, you know, King Solomon's temple was built by the Phoenicians. So, yeah, there was a lot of interaction in the Nile Delta and in that region between the Phoenicians and the Egyptians.
Sounds to me like the Egyptians had the power, but the Phoenicians were the sort of skilled gophers who could get stuff done. You know, obviously they're quite handy people to have around. What period in history are we talking about? Because some people say that the Phoenician civilization really started as far back as about 1500 BC, when we know they were certainly very active around sort of 600 BC. But do you know how far they went back?
Yes, I mean, a lot of chronicles sort of date it from about 1200 BC, but some of the academics are now saying, actually, if you look at the Canaanites, who were, the predecessors to the Phoenicians, nothing really changed between the Canaanites and the Phoenicians. It was the same people, the same civilization, the same cultures, and therefore you could extend the Phoenician history back at least to, say, 2000 BC. So, you know, we're talking about a very ancient civilization that lasted pretty much, you know, two millennia.
Also, think about it, you know, these people would have kept their secrets. I mean, for example, how to design and build a ship, whereabouts to sail that ship to get what you wanted. They would keep that pretty close to their chest. One of the things I know that the Phoenicians did develop was the first phonetic alphabet, which is a pretty amazing thing to invent. And the idea was, before that, all we had was kind of symbols like hieroglyphics and things like that. And they realized, well, actually, it's a lot easier if we just use a language which is about the sounds that we're making when we speak. It makes it a lot easier to write a written language down, because you've got to have so many symbols for so many different things. And the interesting thing I found was just researching this earlier is that other parts of the world seem to pick up the similar system to the Phoenicians, both in alphabet, language, and also in the way they measured things. So that does, I mean, it does suggest that they were using these ships to go further afield than just the Mediterranean.
Yes, I mean, certainly, you know, our modern day alphabet can be traced to the Phoenicians, and possibly the numbering system, although that may have come more from sort of Arabic quarters. But certainly the Phoenician alphabet is the basis of our modern alphabet that was, you know, developed further by the Greeks. But the basis of the modern alphabet spread, and there are clues to the Phoenician alphabet, you know, throughout the Mediterranean and even into parts of West Africa, that the Phoenicians brought the alphabet and their symbols of the alphabet, if you like, with them.
If you're interested in testing this hypothesis of the possibility that one of their rather nice ships could have made it across the Atlantic, is there any evidence that of any kind of signs of a Phoenician style influence in the Americas?
Well, it partly depends on sort of who you ask. And I think at this stage, I would say there's no real absolute proof, but there are some very strong, interesting sort of theories. And I would say the main one is probably the fact that the Cherokee Indians, for example, have what we'd call a Phoenician or a Middle Eastern gene in their DNA. So, and this gene has been identified as arriving possibly a couple of thousand years ago. It's not a modern Middle Eastern gene. So it's come from some people who have, if you like, married into the native, or some of the native Indians on the eastern seaboard of America. And, you know, no one has got a realistic or put forward a plausible explanation other than that this may have been because the Phoenicians or other sailors came across the Atlantic and you know, mixed with the local indigenous people. So that's probably the main one. But there are also botanical pieces of evidence that would imply that there may well have been, you know, transatlantic voyages in ancient times.
So I know that there's been some evidence found in Egyptian tombs that points to potentially to trade with the Americas.
Yes, that's right. So there's evidence from some of the Egyptian mummies that have been excavated that they have found traces of nicotine and cocaine. And, you know, these substances were clearly only found in the New World in ancient times, or, you know, before the arrival of the European adventurers and explorers. So, you know, there has to be an explanation for this. And it'll be interesting as more tombs are opened and more examples are found as to whether we get even more information from this. But that's certainly one of, you know, the botanical pieces of evidence, and quite a lot of the sort of scientific community, if you like, are sort of fairly silent about, you know, how this nicotine or cocaine could have ended up in Egyptian mummies.
Well, I mean, what we're told is Christopher Columbus discovered the Caribbean and South America, even though, of course, there were people already there who'd already discovered it. And John Cabot sailing from Bristol in 1497, financed by the Bardi Bank in Milan, I think, was it? Anyway, in Italy somewhere, discovered Newfoundland and discovered North America. So this is the official, this is what historians will tell you and I. I mean, have you encountered resistance to your theory?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, I mean, you know, we had a great reception when we did our voyage from across the Atlantic from September last year, and we arrived via way of the Dominican Republic, and we arrived in Fort Lauderdale in early February this year. But I was invited to do a talk to the Miami Yacht Club, and I mentioned about the parallels with Columbus. His first voyage, I think, took 35 days. We took 39 days to reach the Caribbean. And I put in my talk about how terrible Columbus had been in really being the grandfather, if you like, of the European slave trade. He was the first person to export 500 slaves back from the Caribbean to Spain. And he treated the indigenous people incredibly cruelly. I mean, I won't bore you with the details, but it was, you know, it was terrible. And quite a few members of the yacht club left my talk before I even really started. And the next day we were asked to leave. You know, we were at anchor just off the yacht club, but we were asked to leave because we'd upset some of the members. So, yeah, it's a very controversial issue in America, as you've probably seen from the recent news.
Bristol too. You know, we've recently toppled the, you know, in 2020, the statue of Edward Colston, the slave trader. Although people have also pointed the finger at John Cabot too, saying that, you know, although he didn't really get involved very much himself, he really started, he did a sort of reconnaissance for the genocide that was to come later. But look, you've hinted there at your trip, but this was no normal trip across the Atlantic, was it? You managed to actually get the first replica Phoenician boat built. I mean, how on earth do you go about, first of all, finding out, getting the plans to build a boat that hasn't been built for thousands of years?
Again, it took a few years to do it. It took us about, or took myself and a team about 3 years to do the research And it was quite painstaking. But eventually, we identified a wreck that was found off of Marseille called the Jules Verne 7 wreck, which is of Phoenician or Aegean origin, dated to 600 BC, which is exactly when we believe the Phoenicians would have made this kind of voyage. And there was enough detail in the planks and the keel of this wreck that Aix-en-Provence University had excavated to give us the information to build a replica. And, you know, and obviously there's more evidence that goes into this because, you know, on Greek vases, for example, there are images of sails of the Phoenician ships and what the rudders look like and that, which is obviously not available in the wreck. But the wreck gave us the plan of the hull, which was the key ingredient. So we believe we've got, you know, the most representative Phoenician ship that's, you know, done ocean, you know, crossings and the like.
So how did you get it built?
Well, what I did, I wanted to build it in one of the great sort of ancient Phoenician ports. So I went down the Lebanese coast, which is really the home of the Phoenicians. And unfortunately, there wasn't really any boat builders who were capable of building it in the ancient way, and certainly not in the sort of time scale that I had in mind. So I then went up into Syria, which also has Phoenician heritage as well, just north of Beirut. And there's a little Phoenician island called Arwad, just opposite to Tartus and east of Cyprus. And there was a community of wooden boat builders. And luckily I found a guy who had been at, as it happened, Southampton University, and he was able to translate for me. And we managed to do a deal with these wooden boat builders to build the Phoenician ship. And once they understood exactly what the project involved, because they weren't used to building it in an ancient way, they built their boats in a fairly modern way, you know, they actually built this replica ship within about 9 months. We started in sort of late 2007, and by August 2008, the boat was ready to launch.
You're obviously a seagoing man, a ship's captain. What can you just describe the boat for us, the ship for us?
Visually, it looks a little bit like a Viking ship with a single square sail, but it's much more curvaceous, if you like, than a Viking ship. So it's 20 meters long, but it's nearly, the beam is nearly 6 meters wide. So it's quite a heavy looking sort of boat. It's got a freeboard of about a meter and a half. So it, from a sort of safety point of view, it's relatively safe and stable, but it's a little bit like a big sort of bathtub, but it's a single masted vessel. But at the stern, all of these ancient boats, whether they're Egyptians, Greeks or Phoenician, had two quarter rudders. And you need at least two men or women to, you know, actually manage the quarter rudders and steer her. But essentially, yeah, single masted square rig. And she's really just a downwind sailor. You can't sail into the wind particularly. So she was effectively would have been a seasonal vessel, really, but a trading vessel. I mean, the Phoenicians did have warships as well, which are thinner and longer with, you know, 20, 50 oarsmen to them. But what we're talking here is about a galley that would have traded metals, ceramics, olive oil, wine, the things that the Phoenicians traded in.
Okay, and what's below decks? It's obviously, you know, if you're going to go across the Atlantic, you're going to be spending quite a lot of time down there. You need to have some facilities.
Yeah, we actually just, below decks, just hung some hammocks across on this voyage. And some of the crew slept on the floor. Other crew members, you know, used the hammocks. We did actually have, at one point, a rat on board. And as soon as everyone knew there was a rat on board, then they got off the deck and started sleeping in the hammock. So that was quite amusing until we managed to catch the rat and drown it. But life on board was relatively challenging.
Okay, so you went round, circumnavigated Africa first before you decided to set off across the Atlantic. What did you learn doing that?
Yeah, the circumnavigation of Africa was a long trip. It took us 2 years and 2 months to circumnavigate Africa because we stopped as we went along. We managed to dodge, the Somali pirates because we did it in sort of 2009, 2010 at the height of the Somali pirates issue. But gradually, as we got to learn how to sail the ship, the process became, easier and easier. And we were able to show that, a Phoenician ship, if you knew what you were doing, you could sail around the Cape of Good Hope in fairly treacherous conditions. I mean, we had 30 to 40 knot winds as we went around the Cape, and we managed to do it reasonably, without incident. So, and that it was possible that these vessels could, sail around Africa. And that's what inspired us to think, well, actually, if they could have done that, then why couldn't they have gone, to the Americas, which has been a big question about the Phoenician civilization, because when you read about some of the accounts, I mean, Strabo, the Greek historian, he talks about the Phoenicians having 300 settlements down the eastern Atlantic coast, sort of from, Iberia down to Morocco, down to West Africa. So if they had 300 settlements there for trade, then the chances that they went out into the Atlantic and crossed it seem to be pretty good for, as far as I can see.
Yes, and you've also got a few islands out there, haven't you, up and down the Atlantic, that they may stop off at halfway.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, Tenerife and the these islands, Madeira, perhaps not so much the Azores, but certainly places like Tenerife, they have found evidence again of Phoenician writing influencing the local peoples, the indigenous people there. So, definitely that would have helped them get partway across the Atlantic for sure.
Now, another connection between Egypt and that part of the world and the particularly South America is the pyramids. I mean, a lot of people may say, well, hang on a minute, this is an interest. It may just be that this is what people want to build and that there's no connection. But some have also said that there was a similar sort of civilization on both sides. Is there any evidence, do you think, that there was some kind of similar influence on the building of, for example, the Mayan pyramids in South America and the Egyptians?
I think it's probably a little bit speculative whether there was actually some correlation. But, I mean, for many years in Mexico, it was taught, as a fact that the Phoenicians came to Mexico, for example. And there's a book that was written about Haiti, over 100 years ago, saying that the Phoenicians came to Haiti, which in those days was the whole island, Dominican Republic and modern day Haiti, and that the peoples there were of Phoenician stock, and they then went onto the mainland. So, it's not beyond possibility that there are some connections, and certainly a lot of people think there are those connections, that they are, realistic. But I think it's probably not, proven at this stage.
So we had thought, you're talking about the Mexicans there being taught one thing. We're taught in Britain that Christopher Columbus and John Cabot were the first over there. There's actually other contenders, aren't there, that like the Vikings you mentioned, and I think certain fishing people as well are supposed to have managed to make it across. And I think, your main object of your trip is to see whether it was possible. I mean, it's a difficult question to answer maybe, but did you find it quite easy sailing over there? Did you find it, you know, challenging? I mean, I suppose, you know, the other thing is if there are storms around, that's obviously going to make things rather awkward. What was your sense for whether it was a difficult trip, having, you know, actually sailed these ships quite a bit around Africa, making it over to the Caribbean or not?
I think actually, yeah, it was relatively straightforward to do the crossing, to be honest. Whilst one would like to sort of say, oh, it was really difficult and hard and stuff, the prevailing winds and currents, come straight off of the Moroccan coast and take you to the Caribbean. So, and with a downwind, square rig like the ancients would have had, you know, there would be no problem. And the Gulf Stream could have taken them back slightly further north via the Azores, across, you know, the Atlantic the other way. So you've got these convectional currents and winds that lead to this kind of journey. And you're absolutely right. There are at least half a dozen accounts of other voyages that may have reached the Americas, but certainly before Columbus and Cabot did. There are stories in the 10th century of Arabic voyages going from Spain across. There is a Mali king in the 13th century who launched two very big expeditions across the Atlantic, one of them with, you know, numerous ships, which one voyage came back and one didn't come back. But there's definitely, when you get into the detail of it, there are many more recordings of voyages which have never, if you like, had the publicity that they, you know, probably deserve.
The Legends of Atlantis. I mean, this is something which most people have heard of. Most people think, oh, that's a load of nonsense. But it may be that seafarers that have been over there and come back that were told not to say anything, you know, might even talk about another place they visited and probably been poo-pooed as conspiracy theorists in medieval times. But, I mean, do you think that there's potentially some sort of link to the Legend of Atlantis here?
I don't actually think so myself, based on sort of what I've read, in the sense that the depth in the Atlantic, it's not really credible. But the couple of things I would say, one is that, you know, there's certainly stories which appear to be true that the Carthaginians, who were really the sort of, you know, the Phoenicians in the Western Mediterranean, that they blockaded the Straits of Gibraltar to stop some of the Greeks and other traders getting access to, you know, the metals and fish supplies in the Atlantic. So, and they were keen to keep secret the riches that were in the Atlantic. But the other thing is too, which comes back perhaps more to the Atlantis story a little bit, is that in the Azores, they have, or, you know, a couple hundred years ago, they found some Carthaginian coins, and this was recorded at the time. And these coins, you know, if that find is true, and as I said, there was a Swedish inquest into this discovery in the 1960s, which it concluded it was genuine. If that's true, because the ancient ships could have only sailed, if you like, from the west, they would have had to get to the Americas, you know, to come back. Then I think, you know, the idea that the Phoenicians or the Carthaginians could have been sailing out in the Atlantic and being quite comfortable with those voyages, it does start to take on a bit of a different meaning.
Do you think the Phoenicians would have ever made it to Bristol?
Well, we know that the Phoenicians, certainly their trade made it to Bristol, because just a few years ago, I'm talking 3-4 years ago, a Phoenician coin was found on the River Avon after a flood, and the British Museum confirmed that they believed it to be genuine, and it proved that there was a Phoenician trade with the West Country. And, although there's perhaps a debate with some of the people in Cornwall as to whether their there was, Phoenician contact. I think the evidence is now growing, and that coin that I mentioned that was found a few years ago definitely shows that Phoenician trade reached Cornwall. And you may have seen, I mean, last year there was an article about a wreck that was found in Israel, in the Mediterranean, but on the Israeli coast. And this wreck had some tin ingots in the wreck. They analysed the tin, and guess where it came from? It came from Devon and Cornwall. They could identify, you know, its signature identified it clearly and scientifically with coming from, you know, South Devon and Cornwall. So, you know, there is no doubt that the Phoenicians were definitely trading with the southwest of England.
Painted with a pretty slick picture of sailing this ancient galley, reconstructed galley, as if it was almost a modern ship without too much trouble. But you've been sailing around the world, to, you know, not the whole way around the world, but you've been sailing all over the place for months in this. You must have had a few moments.
Yes, I mean, for sure. And particularly to start with, we had some very tricky moments in learning how to sail it. You know, at one point in the Red Sea, we nearly sailed it, or I nearly sailed it with my crew, into an oil rig, which was, you know, going to cause a lot of problems. But eventually we got to manage it and then, you know, learn how to manage it. So, and keeping it, off the rocks, keeping it safe, you know, for the last 12 years has been, quite a job. But, yeah, I've spent... during that time, for 3.5 years of my life, actually on board it and, looking after it. But it's, we've had a few, you know, moments, but touch wood, we've got away with the risks involved.
Where is she now?
She's currently in Fort Lauderdale in the States, which is where we ended the expedition. And we're looking really for a long-term home to retire her. You know, and I'm sort of wondering if we found a place either back here in the UK, which where she could be part of a, you know, an attraction and part of a, like a maritime museum or something like that. But, you know, we've also got some interest in the States. There's also a little bit of interest in Beirut that has a new maritime museum. But, we just need to find her a home that could pay off some of the debts that's been incurred in, you know, putting on the expedition and building the ship originally. If we can't find a home in the States in the next year, then next summer we'll bring her back either to the UK or to the Mediterranean and find a long-term home here, this side of the Atlantic. So I think, yeah, it's possible for sure.
It'd be lovely to have her sitting next to the Matthew in the harbour in Bristol, so people could sort of scratch their heads and wonder who really did it first. But anyway, Philip Beale, thanks ever so much for joining us. So if you could just finish by telling our listeners whereabouts they can find out more about your trip and maybe see some photographs of the boat.
Yeah, we have a website, which is PhoeniciansBeforeColumbus.com, but also on Facebook. We have a very active page there, which is Facebook/PhoeniciansBeforeColumbus. So there's lots of pictures, lots of the crew. And if you have interest in this project, then please drop me a line. We've had an article on the Americas. We've had some articles in some quite good publications. The Times did a piece on us, and the Middle East and I did. And I'm hoping that by Christmas we'll have a book out, you know, which I've got a working title of Columbus Came Last, The Voyage of the Phoenicia to the Americas. So I'm hoping to get that finished in time for Christmas.
Okay, Philip Beale, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, that's Philip Beale from PhoeniciansBeforeColumbus.com. I wonder if your views have changed at all, Martin. He sort of dropped in there, didn't he, that they found all these coins from Carthaginian coins in the Azores, which can only have meant that the Carthaginians were going backwards and forwards.
Well, I mean, evidence has to be adjudicated for any of these claims, doesn't it? And if you find Carthaginian coins in the Azores, that wouldn't be that surprising for the reasons he's explained. That doesn't mean that they necessarily went on to North America. He mentioned genetic.
I think you may be misunderstood, but the Azores are on the trade winds coming from back. West to east.
Yeah, coming back.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, and obviously, it creates a great deal of interest, for people to question what they seem to be historical, historical
truth. Is it possible for all these university profs to have got it wrong over the years?
Well, of course it is. I mean, the whole point of genuine investigation is that you're willing to change your views if the facts change. An obvious point to point out was that the very earliest connections by the Europeans with the Americas in the 1500s immediately caused a massive die-off, because they weren't exposed to old world pathogens. Now, if anybody had got there earlier, you might wonder whether that would have happened. You know, why?
Yeah, I mean, that's smallpox you're talking about. Yeah, the same thing. Exactly.
Smallpox, colds, all sorts of stuff.
And the flu.
Most of the pathogens that developed in the old world developed from old world farming, which involves close interaction with livestock. And that's precisely what they didn't have.
Well, and also slum conditions as well, which they didn't have.
Well, no, it's not just that. It's because agriculture developed independently in the Americas, but it was very much plantation agriculture. They didn't really have livestock. And of course, that means that they didn't get exposed to the pathogens of in the old world. And there's a very interesting book that I read some time ago now about The Great Divide, it's called. And it's about how civilization evolved separately in the Americas from, the Eurasian continent, and the very big differences there were in the way that it evolved. One obvious thing that the book points out is that in Latin America, you've got literally hundreds of psychotropic plants, which were clearly very fundamental to the culture. You know, Aztec priests would be dropping mushrooms as they ripped out people's hearts. Whereas, of course, in Eurasia, there was a tradition of using, chemicals, or rather plants, to change consciousness. But gradually, with the invention of farming and the ubiquity of alcohol, the culture changed so that there was a very big difference between the cultural mindsets on the two sides. And of course, the more we find out about human history, the more fascinating it becomes. And with modern genetic techniques, it really does become possible to say where people did and didn't come from. And of course, one of the most controversial aspects of that is that many Ashkenazi Jews probably aren't Semites. But there you go.
Okay, well, finally, the Viking ships, very much like those Phoenician ships, similar. And anyway, the Danes it's just finished with a bit of news from this week. The Danes have given the nod to the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. And the Danish Energy Agency has green-lighted the use of Russian ships that could speed up execution of the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. The US sanctions have attempted to stop all this, so the US sanctions are still sort of changing and extending themselves as we speak in order to try and stop the pipeline, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think they're bringing Russian ships in to do it, because Western-based companies will be subject to sanctions. And since the Russians are under sanctions anyway, it doesn't make any difference to them if they complete the pipeline.
I mean, it seems that the Americans have used a very dirty tactic here. In other words, they've waited until the pipeline is almost finished in before they pull out their final card in order to try and stop it. So it's 775 miles in length. Nord Stream 2 is running from Russia's Ust-Luga, but is to now on hold 160 kilometres off the German coast. So it's getting very, very close to Germany, but the UN sanctions came into force before Christmas, and the Swiss Dutch company had to withdraw its ships, but now apparently the Russians are sailing over to save the day.
Yeah, it's not UN sanctions, it's US sanctions. There's no basis in UN law for them to do this.
No, of course not. No, it's the Americans trying to stop this.
What it's beginning to do is the industrialists in Germany are basically beginning to say, well, you know, we don't really want to be in an alliance with the US. Ultimately, if they're going to carry on bullying us like this, we're going to send, you know, Trump is talking about taking US soldiers out of Germany. And in actual fact, on the left in Germany, people say, well, just take them home. We don't want them. But of course, what Trump's going to do then is he's going to move them into Camp Trump in Poland. And of course, you've got the Polish presidential election coming up on Sunday, which Duda may win. And of course, he's very much pushing for the troops in Germany to be moved into Poland. But of course, from the Russian point of view, it's not really provocative because they can't possibly invade Russia from there. But the Russians have no intention of invading Poland anyway. But what will happen?
Well, it's Poland and Ukraine have been the most vocal against this pipeline.
Yes, because the reason why the Germans and the Russians have cooperated to build it is because both the Poles and the Ukrainians could hold Germany to ransom. I mean, over politics, unless they can get their gas directly from Russia. And of course, this basically shows the way in which the world is changing. A multipolar world is gradually emerging, from under the 500 years of Western domination. Which began with the discovery of the Americas.
Okay, the US sanctions, apparently the US Congress is discussing a new sanctions bill with extend the scope of the already imposed penalties targeting the insurers. Companies working on related pipeline activities such as trenching. The key provision of the newly proposed sanction is to hit entities that provide certification services. So the Americans are trying to do everything to stop this. At the very last minute. I mean, how come the US can decide on a pipeline that's being laid right in the Baltic? It's a sea, undersea pipeline, isn't it?
Well, because the Americans rule the world and they want full spectrum dominance. And ultimately, if they keep on this road, they will end NATO. And the world will be a very different place.
Anyway, the Danes want the pipeline. The Germans want the pipeline. The Danish decisions make it much easier and cheaper for Russia to complete Nord Stream 2, said Anna Mikulska from Rice University in Texas. Now, the question is whether the already existing US sanctions would then apply to Gazprom. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, do you think they'll finish the pipeline or not, Martin?
I think they will, yeah. I mean, the Germans will be very, very put out noses out of joint if it's not finished. Don't forget they've invested loads of money in it. And of course, what the Americans really hate is the idea that Germans...
It's $11 billion, by the way, 10 billion euros.
Yeah, well, what they really hate is the idea that German industry with cheap Russian gas is going to undersell them. And of course, they want them to buy more expensive gas from the United States so that they can keep their fracking industry going. And you've got to remember that, you know, the American Empire is about to make America great again. It's not
yeah, and
make
it's back,
Germany
it's back
great
to,
again, is it?
Back to the energy business again, isn't it? Anyway, fascinating way to finish, I think, sort of looking at that pipeline because, I mean, the amazing thing is, Martin, with all this money that's been invested in it, it wouldn't take much, a little missile in its bust, isn't it?
Well, no, it's actually been laid under the sea to avoid exactly that.
Surely they can put explosives under the sea and someone could blow it up.
Well, if somebody does then that's an act of war, isn't it? So you've got to expect retaliation.
Like the assassination of Soleimani.
Well, indeed. we're on, you know, the US empire in its death throes is probably more dangerous than it's ever been. And that doesn't really make any difference who wins the election in November. There's going to be a reckoning of enormous proportions. They've been living basically on tick on the back of the petrodollar system that we discussed earlier. And as that unravels, you're going to see massive, possibly destructive changes.
And this attempt to destroy the Nord Stream pipeline is vicious, because really all it's doing is reacting to the fact that the United States is a has-been empire that can't compete anymore.
Well, it's vicious. I mean, the whole extraterritorial sanctions that the US seems to be insisting on, in other words, the sanctions supposedly have to be agreed by the UN. But if you impose them without UN agreement, they're an act of war in themselves. And of course, the US is at war with the developing world. It is at war with the Russian leadership. It is at war. It wants to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party. They are determined to have full spectrum dominance. And Britain, of course, is going to be caught up in this. There's going to be massive trade wars. We're going to have a trade war in which we are going to be a little cork in the middle of a sea of tsunamis of everybody slapping tariffs on everybody else, which is what happened in the 1930s.
Well, let's just
and we know where that ended.
Let's just hope Britain can feed itself in the meantime. We shall see. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s, listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 with Danny Loch, always worth a listen. Do please join us for our politics show live stream, the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.